Imagine with me, it is sometime in the early 1870s. It's a Saturday evening in New England, or perhaps even here in Rockford, Illinois. And in the living room of a fancy home with lit candles and woven tapestries, carved wooden chairs, about a dozen people sit around. They wear the fashion of the time, and you can tell they are respectable and educated people. After some welcoming conversation, some how are yous, they become still. A few candles are strategically blown out, and the seance begins. Stillness for a while, until one person begins their communication with the dead. They speak as the departed. Some of it makes sense, some doesn't, but everyone is enchanted. This goes on for a while. Not everyone around the circle speaks for the dead, and not everyone hears who they hope to hear, but they leave convinced that they have communicated beyond the veil. Sunday morning, the next day, the same town, the bell rings at the local Unitarian and Universalist church, and the same people, dressed in their church best this morning, walk through the streets, through the door, and take their place in their designated pew. Yes, there were assigned seats back then, and in fact, you paid more to sit up close. Can you imagine? It's true. And that morning in the early 1870s, the preacher mounted the pulpit and spoke about the new scientific idea of the time, evolution and natural selection, and how it was clear that this was the way that God worked through science to bring about growth and progress and the new, and how we religious liberals should embrace the science to better understand the universe and the holy. The stories I have just told you are true. We talk a lot about our historic embrace of evolution. In particular, this church really was sort of founded and refounded because the minister at the Baptist church started believing in evolution and came over to pastor the Unitarians. We talk a lot about evolution, but we don't talk a lot about how at the same time we also embraced spiritualism and the seances with the dead. Now we might say, how could they believe both, something so outlandish on one hand and something so scientifically true on the other? But those people at that time, however, did not see those things as contradictory in any way. It did not occur to them to be skeptical of the seance, at least until 1876, when a major debunking of the practice was published. They showed the images and the secret tricks that the mediums would use, and the fad began to die. Unitarians and Universalists in particular got very excited about seances and spiritualism and communication with the dead up until 1876. Of course, it's understandable. It was a decade or so after so many of them had lost their husbands, their brothers, and their sons in the Civil War. So of course they wanted to talk to them. Let us not forget the pastoral context. Our longing for something to be true, for something to make sense, can sometimes overwhelm our scientific reason. We like explanations and patterns. We like connections. Our brains are hardwired to draw connections between things. It's how our great ancestors learned how to survive. We are evolutionarily hardwired to mistake correlation for causality because it takes too long to think, so you act with instinct. And it takes a great effort then to be more rigorous. Our history is full of examples of great science. Joseph Priestley, one of the first Unitarian preachers in America, also categorized oxygen and discovered and invented carbonation. So every time you have a fizzy drink, thank a Unitarian. Astronomers, biologists, inventors, physicists, our ranks are full of these folks. Our theologians continue to this day to plumb the depths of evolution and cosmology and quantum mechanics and the rest to bridge the gap between religion and science. And there was a time in our history when Unitarians got really excited about phrenology, the racist so-called science of measuring head shape to determine intelligence and personality. And even to this day, there's an unfortunate overlap, particularly on the West Coast, but not just there, between low vaccine communities and some Unitarian Universalist churches, despite the moral imperative to protect the vulnerable by vaccinating yourself and your children. The line between science and pseudoscience is a fine one. And this history lesson I started with is designed to remind us all that it isn't always easy to tell the difference at the start. So when we talk about the truth about the stuff of the universe, about stardust and quarks and ecosystems and minds and everything, when we talk about the truth about stuff and about how our liberal religion embraces science as a way toward truth, I do not want us to get self-congratulatory. I do not want us to forget to examine our own assumptions and habits and test them for rigor. Liberals should be, and generally are, less prone to conspiracy theories and nonsense notions, but we are not immune. How do we know what scientific ideas, what ideas about stuff, about the universe and humanity and the way things work that we should believe? How do we know what's true? The latest health fad? The study that got mentioned on the radio for 1 minute and you were sort of paying attention? The article somebody read and kind of summarized for you? What your eighth grade science teacher told you a long time ago and you kind of sort of remember? That thing you saw on Facebook, how do you know what's true about GMOs and BPA and DNA and MMT and ESP? How do you know what's true? I can't guarantee that my method will work, but here's what I try to do. Be skeptical, but not cynical. Ask hard questions, but don't dismiss everything new. Stay open to learning. Know what you know. My physics knowledge is all right. I can read an article and make a decent assessment of its plausibility, but you want me to weigh in on microbiology, and I'm gonna have to ask somebody else. Be willing to say, I don't know. Find sources you trust. Facebook isn't one of them. Neither are YouTube videos set on a loop. Please don't believe either of those things. Follow the lead of genuine experts when you don't know as much. Keep learning. Stay humble. Keep learning. If you read or hear something, investigate. Or ask someone who knows about that subject. The more outlandish the thing you hear, the less likely. Check Snopes. It is your friend. Stay humble. And keep learning. Also, distrust neat answers that solve everything. Remember that our brain is hardwired to mistake correlation with causation. And if a theory seems too clever by half, it probably is. Quantum mechanics, chaos theory, and ecology means that things are always more complicated. And if the truth doesn't fit on a postcard, and we should keep our wonder alive. I also think it's appropriate to keep a justice frame when we consider ideas. This doesn't mean we should judge scientific ideas based on moral considerations, but given the history of pseudoscience being used to justify racism, sexism, colonialism, ableism, and so forth, we should be very careful when a scientific idea seems to justify existing power hierarchies. We mock the idea now, as we should, that the shape of your head determines your personality. But some people continue to think that the genes for melatonin are related to the genes for intelligence or even worthiness. They're wrong. I do get a little kick when somebody online or somewhere says something like, look, either you're XY or XX and that's that, and then the geneticists all write in to say you're completely wrong and you know nothing about genetics, let alone about gender. I do appreciate when the experts weigh in. Another justice frame worthy of being applied is about nature and ecology and other species, all creatures, great and small. When Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey published their findings about how other primates formed communities and communicated and cared for each other and so on, a lot of the male scientists said, no way. They said, those women got too close to those apes. They weren't objective enough. They cared about them too much. But it turned out that caring about them was exactly right, and that Drs. Goodall and Fossey were right. And those who thought that the apes, like the dolphins and the whales, were just stuff, were wrong. So I give a greater benefit of the doubt to science that treats ecology as important and other species as worthy of respect than I give to science that justifies exploitation and abuse. Keep learning, be humble, check your sources, look for wonder, value respect. These are good rules for scientific literacy. They're also good rules for the religious life. I was 13 when I was reading A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking. This is my same copy from then. You can tell by that my name in the front cover and the bad handwriting. At the time, I was interested in being a physicist. I wanted to understand the universe. I wanted to understand the Big Bang and where we come from and how it's connected and what happens if the universe stops expanding. And are there other universes? And what happens at the edge of a black hole? And I liked the names of the quarks, those basic building blocks of everything smaller than protons and electrons. Their names are up, down, top, bottom, strange, and charm. Isn't that great? I want to know everything about them. And as I turned the pages that summer, I had a realization growing in my mind that though my math skills were good, they weren't that good. Better than average? Yeah. Amazing? No. I took the book with me to summer camp that year. I was almost finished, Unitarian Universalist summer camp, and I wanted to finish it. So I read it during the afternoon break sometimes, and then it sat on the grass at night with the other youth, a few hours outside of Seattle, Washington, and stared at the stars. It's the time of year when the August meteor shower happened every year. I finished the book there at camp, the last few paragraphs, which I read to you. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of why we and the universe exist, for then we would know the mind of God. And I thought, that's what I want. I don't want to do the maths. I want to be in the discussion about what it means for life, our own lives, and all. And then at that same summer camp that summer, I led the youth worship service. At the youth-led worship service, it was maybe the next night, I preached a little homily about friendship, actually, not about physics at all. My first time in a pulpit. And afterwards, someone said, have you ever thought about ministry? That, as they say, was that. So what does it mean? What does it mean for life? Assuming we exercise some scientific literacy, check our sources, stay humble, keep learning, and apply a justice frame, and we get a decent understanding of the discoveries of science, physics and biology and neuroscience and ecology and everything, what does it mean? What does it mean that we are stardust? And to stardust we shall return. What does it mean that all life is related at the level of DNA to each other? What does it mean that small changes, butterfly wings flapping, can make big changes later? What does it mean that great apes play and elephants bury their dead and dolphins laugh? What does it mean, as the neurobiologists now say, that though our brain is in our head, our mind is made in relation to the world and our body and each other? What does it mean that the particles in everything, our hand, the oak tree, the stone, the star that twinkles from millions of years ago, its light finally reaching us, that the particles in everything vibrate and can't be plotted on a map without moving them and are always connected? What does it mean? What is the truth about stuff? The seventh principle of our associational covenant puts it this way, that we should have respect for the interdependent web of life of which we are a part. When that was written in the mid-1980s, we didn't even know one-tenth of how interdependent we really are. Each discovery makes us more connected. What does it mean? Wonder and honor, respect and care, awe and service. To simply receive these gifts without offering something in return robs us of a reciprocal relationship with the earth. If we malama the aina will malama us. What does it mean? To lie under the stars, to move softly through the forest, to know that from stardust we are and to stardust we return. It should move us to reverence, a sacred respect for the earth, our home, for each other, our siblings, for other forms of life, our cousins, for our own body, a miracle. The more I know about science and biology and physics and everything, the more blown away I am. The more I know about how we are all connected, the more tragic and painful it is when those connections are broken, when the earth is treated like a dump, when people hurt each other, when hatred and oppression and violence destroys. Do you not know? Do you not see? How could you forget? You are sacred, and so is that which you aim to destroy. Turn away from destruction. Turn toward relationship, toward care, toward wonder. Do you not know? It is amazing that we exist. We're all connected. We owe existence, ourselves, each other, the earth, a duty of relationship, of care, of kindness, of malama. But it's not just a duty. It is a joy to be in the garden, to taste that ripe vegetable, to see the sun on water, to know right under the ground a tulip bulb right now is starting to push its way toward the air as we speak. Knowledge, they say, drives wonder from the world. They say it still, though, all is glory. So we say, no, it doesn't. We say, knowledge one day shall be song, and that in knowledge deeper reverence be. Wonder is only expanded and relationship strengthened, for indeed, life is the greatest gift of all. Creatures great and small, and we are of life, and our vision soars on wings, our grateful spirit sings. What is the truth of stuff? That we are made of it. That all things are made of it, and that all things are connected and full of wonder. If we but seek it, open ourselves to beauty, awe, right there in particles we cannot see and the far outreach of space and everything in between and in each other, the eyes that stare into your eyes, the hand you touch, the heartbeat you feel, all connected, all stardust. All companions, on this blue-green earth. So let us learn evermore, let us wonder evermore, and let us care evermore. And let us sing your teal hymnal this time, 1064. In a moment, I'll extinguish our chalice and read our benediction, and we'll sing our blessing. And I invite you to do one of three things: to place your hands on your shoulders if you'd rather not be touched, place your hands together if it's okay if other people put their hands on your shoulders, or join hands with one another. 11:30 is the Justice for All conversation in the library. We'll try that and see how many we are. And I'll extinguish now our chalice. But not the light of community, the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry with us until we are together again. The words of our benediction from the writer Annie Dillard. We are here to abet creation and to witness to it, to notice each other's beautiful face and complex nature, so that creation need not play to an empty house. We'll sing together our sung benediction. The words are in your order of service. We'll sing it together twice in the plural on the second time through.